In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about how it is, where it is that people get their power. Back in the days when people first started to get electricity in their homes, people got their power from stations that were, relatively speaking, small and located not that far from where they lived. Over time, however, that changed. The economics favored bigger and bigger and bigger generating plants. And so now we have power plants that are very, very large and big enough to generate enough power to power entire cities. And also they tend to be a long way away, significant way away from the customers. There's a lot of distance, a lot of wire between the plant and the end user, particularly we're talking about here residential customers. However, now again, because of economics and also because of technology, things seem to be turning around again. And some people argue that, in fact, now there are good arguments to think once again about having smaller generators, having them closer to the end user. And we'll be talking about here this morning with Dr. Joel Swisher. He is a principal and team leader of energy and resource services with the Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass, Colorado. This is the outfit that's headed by Amory Lovins, and is very, very interested in things that have to do with energy, how it's used, and how it's produced. His PhD in energy and environmental engineering is from Stanford. He's done a lot of research, written a lot of articles. He's done consulting work with RMI's energy and resources team for some high-profile clients, including City of San Francisco and some large corporations. And he is one of the authors of a recent report that Rocky Mountain has done. Looking at this, it's titled Small is Profitable, The Hidden Economic Benefits of Making Electrical Resources the Right Size. This came out last fall and is available from them. If you're interested, you can go to their website and you can download the executive summary so you can get a sense of what's in there. And of course, if you're interested in reading it, you can get a copy from them. It's available in book form and has a lot of information in it. Questions and comments are welcome here on the program, too. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Any point here you have questions, you can call us. Dr. Swisher, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
A pleasure.
We appreciate it. Maybe we just talk a little bit about the history of electricity generation and talk about how things, over time, how things changed, sort of where they started out, and then how it is that the trends, it seemed to make sense for us to have big plants, and now things are turning around. So what did it look like right at the beginning when people were first getting electricity?
Well, at the beginning, most of the interest in electricity was either for lighting, and of course at that time the main interest for lighting was to provide light at night when it was dark. And ironically, now we use most of our electricity that goes into lighting during the day, which is odd. The other use was for industrial power, and typically that was done in conjunction with providing process heat and steam in factories of various different sorts. And the electricity in those facilities was generated right on site from a fuel resource. And then the idea of an electrical grid first became interesting when with the advent of a light bulb and the ability to generate power, connect it to people's houses and provide them light so that they could see at night rather than, using kerosene or whale oil or whatever was being used at the time. And I guess the thing historically that drove your recap was actually quite accurate. What drove the centralization of the electricity sector over time was two things. One was the economics. There seemed to be more and more powerful so-called economies of scale. That is, as things got bigger, they seemed to get cheaper. But in addition to that, there was a whole question of reliability and the fact that the power plants weren't too reliable and the chance of anyone going out at any given time was pretty high. So if you were completely reliant on one prime mover to make your electricity and it failed, well, you were in the dark. And so the idea of having a grid that would link together a whole bunch of different generators, any one of which might go down at any given time, but together they were all pretty reliable, seemed like a very advantageous way of providing more reliable power as well as making it cheaper. And for a very long time, that logic really prevailed.
Hmm. Well, though, what happened though then to, at least for a period of time again, to move to this trend that said, well, it really makes sense for us to build a really power plant. We can put it out in the middle of nowhere so it won't bother anybody, and we'll just string a long wire from there to where it is that people want it.
Yeah. Again, there were a couple of things. The economics was one. The reliability was another. The fact that that wire is generally, you know, no moving parts unless there's a big storm that knocks down the wire or a suicidal squirrel that shorts the lines and causes an outage, which actually does happen fairly often, or some other fairly unusual problem. The wires are pretty reliable in comparison to the power plants with thousands of pounds of steam going through them and lots of moving parts and lots of things that can fail. And then the third thing was the increasing environmental regulation that was, of course, really emphasizing trying to clean up specifically concentrated polluted areas, urban areas, and therefore there was a push to move power plants out of those places. And so that's when you had a lot of development, particularly in the southwest, of big power plants, mostly powered by coal, that are pretty far away from the cities like, you know, Los Angeles, for example, that they serve. And really what they're doing is they're just moving the pollution source away from the users of the electricity and linking them back up via the power grid.
Hmm. So what is happening now? What are the factors now that seem to be turning us again lead a lot of you folks and a lot of other people to say, well, this way we have been doing it with large centralized generators located maybe long, long away from the end user, that's now doesn't really make very much sense anymore, and it would be a good idea to go back, in a sense, to think about it the way that we had originally thought about it, with much more decentralized generation and putting that closer to the end user.
Yeah, I guess one thing to clarify is we're not really calling for, you know, removing the grid as it's been built up, but rather complementing it with a lot of more decentralized sources, trying to get sort of the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. But you're right, that as we studied in the course of this work on the book Smallest Profitable, the history of the power sector, you know, we found this sort of wave of increasing centralization, which has now sort of turned around. And there's a whole bunch of different reasons, none of which is any one dominant one. Some of the pressures have to do with the restructuring of the industry in many states where they're no longer integrated utility companies that generate power, transmit it, distribute it, and serve customers. There's more environmental constraints relative to some of the technologies like coal-fired power and nuclear power, which are not being built as much as they were 20, 30 years ago. Concern for reliability on the part of certain customers, say data centers, banks, high-tech facilities, but more and more types of customers wanting reliability, even above and beyond what the grid, which is already pretty good, can provide. There's a fair amount of deterioration in the aging infrastructure in the grid, and it's going to be harder and more expensive to even maintain the level of service that it provides today. There's issues about energy security and the vulnerability of this centralized infrastructure, which we've done a fair amount of work on as well. And I guess the other thing driving it is technology. We have new small power generation technologies and so-called cogeneration, which is when you combine the production of heat and electricity and even cooling at one site, kind of the way that the power sector started out. And in the course of this wave of centralization, we sort of turned our back on the very efficient use of energy in this cogeneration scheme. And that's coming back. There's much more interest in it as an efficient way of using fuel, kind of killing two birds with one stone. And there are now technologies available at a much smaller scale that can provide power at higher efficiency, at lower cost, and very importantly, with lower emissions. If we talk about, from an environmental standpoint, moving your power supply back closer to the end user. There's a lot of good reasons to do that, but one of the objections is bound to be, well, you know, that's where people live and work, so if there's a lot of pollution, I don't want it here. That was one of the reasons to move the power plants out to the desert, let's say. Well, therefore, that requires that small generation technologies be cleaner and cleaner, and that's happening too.
Maybe I should just introduce once again our guest for this part of Focus 580, and we're talking with Joel Swisher. He is principal and team leader of Energy and Resources Services at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass, Colorado. And if you're interested, by the way, in exploring this subject in greater depth, you could look at a report that the folks at Rocky Mountain have put together, and he's one of the authors that came out, I think, last fall, titled Small is Profitable, The Hidden Economic Benefits of Making Electrical Resources the Right Size. And again, this is something that you can get from them if you're interested in taking a look at the executive summary or ordering one. Probably the easiest thing to do is to go to their website, which is www.rmi for Rocky Mountain Institute, rmi.org, and you can find out about that and other things that they do there at Rocky Mountain. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back here and pick up on maybe have you talk a little bit more about one of the points that you touched on, and that's the issue of reliability, because I think it's really on a lot of people's minds lately. Around here it has been, and nationally it has been. And I think one of the things you point out in the report is that if you take a look at business of generating and supplying power, if you look at where the potential problems are, and actually if you look at where the costs are, it's not in the generation, it's in the grid. It's in getting it from where it's generated to the end user. Does moving towards a kind of system that you're talking about here, a more decentralized kind of system, what does that do to address that concern about wanting to make sure that the power is there when you need it?
Well, it can give you the ability to provide sort of premium reliability that is higher than what the grid provides. The grid already today probably gives us 99.5 or 99.7% reliability, which is really pretty good. And for most traditional uses of electricity, no one really expected or probably was willing to pay for anything higher than that. But today, particularly with high-tech facilities and the digital economy, we certainly have a growing share of the power demand that really needs 99.99, et cetera. And there's really no way to make the grid that much more reliable with any kind of reasonable cost. And so rather than attempt to do that, what you need to do is to combine the reliability of the grid power with the ability to generate power right on site. And typically, the way that is done is you have emergency generators. In other words, they're often old, noisy, smoky diesel units that when the power goes down, well, there's some batteries that carry the load for a few seconds or minutes, and then these diesel units come on and they run as long as the power's out, and then they transition back to the grid when it comes back on. So they're only designed, in fact, they're usually only allowed by law to operate a few hours a year because they're not very efficient and they're not very clean and they're not very quiet. But what we're talking about is really designing a power supply to run all the time in parallel with the grid, but also have the ability to provide backup power if the grid should go out. And that's technically doable and feasible, but it's actually very unusual for on-site generators to be connected in such a way that they can do both, that is, provide power most of the time, perhaps heating and cooling as well, and then be able to run in what electrical engineers call an island, that is a separate little mini system separated from the grid if the grid should go out. The utility planners and engineers are very concerned about the possible safety problems if you should have a separate generator running on an island and then have to reconnect to the grid. If there's a problem, you could damage equipment, you could even hurt people, kill people, if you have currents running the wrong direction. So they've pretty actively discouraged that, but we see that as one of the keys to really being able to provide the power reliability the promise of premium reliability that distributed generation could deliver. And I should say that all the discussion we're having here and a lot of what we discuss in the book about reliability is thinking in terms of traditional thinking of preventing accidental outages or accidental equipment failures from causing the customer to lose power or lose service. There's a whole different aspect of it, which we're starting to think about a little bit again, which is what happens if someone tries to damage the grid on purpose through sabotage, let's say. And under that kind of a situation, the centralized grid appears to be even more vulnerable, and we really haven't done very much at all to date to try to make it more robust in the sense of being able to withstand intentional failures.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that, so starting with one in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about fuel cells and wondering if someday those will be used for power generation, and also if they'll be if you think they'll be used like in a home. So, in, you know, maybe down by my furnace, I'd have a fuel cell that would, you know, tie right into the circuit panel and provide my service right there, and I wouldn't have to pay Illinois Power or Commonwealth Edison or whoever anything, and just supply my own power that way. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and we're pretty bullish, I guess you'd say, on fuel cell technology, in particular for generating power. If you look through the book Small is Profitable, or we also have another much smaller document that applies some of these ideas specifically to the potential for fuel cells, there's a number of benefits that you can get from having a small source of power at the point of use. I mentioned the heating and cooling benefit. We talked about the reliability benefit. There's the possibility of actually supporting the grid by having power sources out closer to the use. It has electrical engineering benefits. And then there's also the need for very clean power, as we said, if indeed the source is close to where people live and work. And if you think about all those benefits, fuel cells really address them very well. It's really kind of in the sweet spot of providing all of these potential benefits, because fuel cells are very, very clean. The only real effluent is hot water, which is useful in and of itself. And they can run very reliably. The real disadvantage right now is simply that they're still sort of in a pre-commercial stage. They're very expensive. So we see fuel cells as being kind of the perfect distributed generation technology. It doesn't completely eliminate your energy bill, because you do need a source of fuel. It could be natural gas, or you could use, for example, off-peak power to make hydrogen fuel and run the fuel cell when power is more expensive. But you probably do still have an energy bill of some sort. As far as where all these benefits might accrue and where fuel cells will make sense to generate power, it seems to us that probably the sweet spot is going to be in the commercial sector, and places where they need a lot of heat and power and cooling all together during a lot of hours of the day or of the year, and where they can take advantage of some of these benefits such as reliability. It seems completely feasible, and there's certainly lots of companies working on products to harness fuel cell technology for residential use in the home. However, it seems to us that that business proposition will be less compelling in the near term. We think that fuel cells will make sense first in the commercial, maybe small industrial sector, and probably only later will they be cost-effective for home use. But there will be products on the market, I think, fairly soon, and there are already some demonstration projects using fuel cells to provide heating and power in individual houses.
All right, so let's go to another caller. This is someone on line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Once again, you folks in the Rocky Mountain Institute have come out with great ideas, but especially with the current administration in Washington, how do you even get through to people to change standards and policies that are all determined by those who like the current current administration, and they have, you know, powerful lobbies who are in favor of basically the status quo.
Well, I think one advantage that we have is that in the electricity sector, most of the policy is not made in Washington. It's actually made at the state level. And so, in a sense, we have 50 different electricity policies or regulatory policies in 50 different states. So there's sort of a bunch of different laboratories all trying different things, some of which have been successful and others not so much. And in that way, we're finding that some states are actually pretty supportive of distributed energy, of energy efficiency, which we always see as being sort of the first priority in trying to reduce both the cost and the environmental impact of power use, is to make sure that we use energy as efficiently as possible through the best cost-effective technology for using energy, whether it's lighting, whether it's industrial power, or what have you. So in terms of policies, there's a lot of action at the state level, and some are rather more sympathetic with some of the federal policies that you mentioned, and others are more progressive in terms of looking at the potential for renewable energy, for distributed power, as we're discussing today, and for efficiency. I guess the other thing is that we also work more with local governments, certain cities and municipalities, some of which have their own utilities and have policy control over them, are interested in some of these approaches, as well as working specifically with the private sector in terms of large power users who want to reduce their environmental impact, reduce their emissions, reduce their costs, of course, and also the manufacturing sector, people who are interested in making things like fuel cells, who are trying to reduce some of the barriers in order that they can open up markets for themselves. So, you know, it is a rather difficult environment at the federal level right now for a lot of these solutions, but you have to sort of work where you have more traction.
A little bit past the midpoint here of this hour of Focus, I should introduce again our guest, Dr. Joel Swisher. He's principal and team leader of Energy and Resources Services at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass, Colorado. He has more than 20 years' experience in many aspects of clean energy technology, has Ph.D. in Energy and Environmental Engineering from Stanford, and is one of the authors of this report we've talked about that came out last fall from Rocky Mountain, Small is Profitable, the Hidden Economic Benefits of Making Electrical Resources the Right Size. And it goes into this in considerable depth. And if you're interested, you can go to their website, rmi.org, and take a look at the executive summary. And you can also order a copy from them if you want to read it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. But back at the beginning, we were talking a little bit about these trends that we've seen in the electricity business, starting out in the beginning where, again, as you explained, we tended to have small generators and they were located relatively, you know, closely to the end user. And then for a number of reasons, the plants got bigger and bigger. They got farther away from the end user. And that made sense for a while. But now what you and other people are arguing is that we should maybe return to the original idea, maybe we're not talking about getting rid of the mega power plant, nor having everybody have a neighborhood power plant either. But having, you know, sort of said that, I guess I want to make sure people kind of have a sense of what we're talking about. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what the kind of system you're talking about would look like.
Okay. Well, what it would look like today would be typically, let's say, in a large commercial building, maybe a bank or a public administration building, you would have somewhere in the attic or the basement, you'd have a small room that would have probably an engine or a small gas turbine that would use probably natural gas, and it would make some electricity, which would go into the building's own internal grid, and it may or may not be as much as the building uses. It probably wouldn't be so much that they would export power to the grid, but they would offset a lot of their own demand. And it would also produce waste heat, and that heat would be recovered, and it would be used to heat the space or process water or domestic water or washing, that sort of thing. It could also be used in a what's called an absorption air conditioner. It could make cooling as well. We don't think of heat being able to make you cooler, but there's technology to do that. So it would just provide an alternative source of energy, heating, cooling, and electricity for the existing or the normal building system components. And you probably wouldn't notice it if you went into a building like that. It would probably look just like the building next door.
Well, this gets into something interesting that we have talked about, and I'm sure people an idea that people find interesting, and that is that in various kinds of buildings, we could be talking about public buildings, commercial buildings, or residences,
mm-hmm.
Looking at ways in which, particularly using renewable energy, that people could satisfy some of their own energy need, and even going a step further, producing more energy than they would use, and then feeding that back into the grid with something called reverse metering.
Metering, yes.
That idea that when you need power, you could buy it from wherever it was being provided. But if you had something like that, maybe you could imagine getting to the point where people might have a fuel cell, might have solar collectors, might have windmill, whatever that is, that if they actually were generating more power than they could use, they could, in effect, sell it back to the power company. And a lot of people found that idea pretty attractive. There seemed to be an awful lot of hurdles, though, technical, regulatory hurdles that would actually have to be cleared before that could actually happen. But is that something is that part of the kind of model that you're thinking about?
Absolutely. And today it's actually fairly easy to do that at a rather small scale. It gets a lot more difficult as you go to a larger scale, as I was describing, say, with a large building. But for small customers, even residential users, if you have something like a solar power system, a so-called photovoltaic generator, which is just flat panels on your rooftop that convert sunlight directly into electricity, again, they're still fairly expensive, but there's some states and some utilities have some pretty good incentives. They typically, because the sun is strongest in the early afternoon and, of course, not producing any energy at night, it doesn't fit your usage perfectly. And so typically you might have a system that could produce a little bit more than you need during the afternoon, and then you would need to draw power from the grid at night. And so the so-called net metering provisions, which a number of states have, and to be honest with you, I don't know about Illinois, but the idea there is that you pay for power when you're using more than you're producing, and then when you're producing more, you essentially spin the meter backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're being paid essentially your full retail rate that you're charged for power that you use for the power you produce. And usually the main provision to do that is there's two things, a limit on the maximum you can produce. It's 10 kilowatts or 100 kilowatts or 1,000 kilowatts, depending on where you are. And the other thing is that they typically only allow you to produce as much as you use or less. You can't actually become a net seller of power over the year. But you'd have to have a pretty big system to do that on a house anyway, so that's not a big issue for residential users. Where it gets difficult with the interconnection issues and the commercial arrangements is with larger commercial systems. And there's still a lot of need for reform and for innovation in the regulatory structure, in most states, actually, to make it easier for larger customers, whether they're producing solar power or whether they're producing cogeneration, as we discussed earlier, and selling it back to the grid.
Let's go on here. I think we have another caller and a couple of callers. Next would be in line would be Urbana in line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, this may be a little off of what you're talking about, but I'm thinking about building a house in the spring and talking to contractors about the use of geothermic furnaces. Now, I'm going to hang up and let you, if you know anything about that, a little bit of a take on this, not okay.
Okay, I think what you mean is a geothermal heat pump.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's actually, and I think in your climate, probably a pretty good approach. The idea of a geothermal heat pump, a heat pump is basically the same thing as an air conditioner. It's a device that moves heat from a place that's colder to a place that's warmer. And the opposite of how heat normally flows from hot to cold. If you want it to flow from hot to cold, you just open the window. But if you want to go from cold to hot, you have to push it. You have to use energy. That's what an air conditioner does. That's what a refrigerator does. And a heat pump does the same thing. The only difference with a heat pump is it's reversible. You can, in the winter, you can take heat out of the environment and put it into your space to keep you warm. And in the summer, you switch it around. You take heat out of your space, which cools you, and you reject it to the environment. Now, if the environment that you're moving heat in and out of with a heat pump is the outdoor air, it's pretty inefficient. If you use the ground instead, which is at a very constant temperature over the course of the year, you know, it's 50-some-odd degrees almost all year, you have a much more efficient source and sink to take heat out in the winter, reject it in the summer. And so a ground source heat pump is just that. It couples your space that you're trying to heat and cool to the ground. And the way it works is, again, it's just like an air conditioner, but rather having that little box, a heat exchanger outside the window rejecting heat, you have a coil that goes down into the ground. It's kind of like a well. And all it is a heat exchanger. It has enough area to heat or cool the working fluid of the heat pump cycle to more or less the temperature of the ground, which is this nice constant sort of 50-some degrees, and it makes for a very efficient way to use electricity to heat and cool a building.
Well, that was what I'm seriously considering. So, but thank you
for
the...
Yeah, it's a little more expensive up front, but I think that you'll find that it's, you know, the life cycle cost is pretty attractive. And again, if you're building a house, try to make it as energy efficient, well insulated, and you know, try to get some solar orientation in the south side to get free heating from the sun.
Sounds good.
Good luck.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. In the past, in the distant past, we used to talk about superconductivity when it was very cold. And then there was some developments towards high-temperature superconductivity that would work at a much more reasonable temperature. It seems that that technology there would save an enormous amount of money and electricity.
There are some commercial products available today that do use high-temperature superconductivity. Again, high temperature is relative to absolute zero, so
it's got
to be pretty cold. but they're beginning to be used in. I mean, the advantage of superconductivity is the electric resistance goes essentially to zero as you move power through a superconductor, rather than having the resistance and the losses that you have from normal copper wire or whatever. So the applications that are being that are already happening, although still on a fairly small scale, are in some power lines in places where they need very, very high currents and they're constrained in terms of space and constrained into how much heat can be rejected. Also in some transformers that convert the voltage of power supply from a higher to a lower voltage or vice versa, and again, where there's particular constraints. And also in storage technology, you can store electricity in an electric field by having a constant current running. And again, if you have no losses, that becomes a fairly efficient, attractive way to do it. And there are some products now available for electricity storage using superconductors. So it's a new, just I think emerging commercially field, particularly in the power industry for some of these applications in terms of transmission transformers and power storage, and I don't think again, like a lot of technologies, it's fairly expensive in terms of its initial cost, which is then justified by the savings you get later. And I think you'll find superconductivity having more and more applications, perhaps even in things like motors, over time as people find more practical ways to use the materials and to maintain their they're fairly finicky operating conditions as far as being very cold and all that sort of thing. So it's happening.
They have not come up with a conducting material that is closer to room temperature.
I haven't heard of any new materials that are much closer than the properties that were of the materials that were discovered, I think, in the late 80s.
I had heard that there were some that were like maybe 50 or 60 degrees below zero or something like that. Nothing like those tremendously low temperatures.
Well, I'm not an expert in this field. There may be such materials now in existence, but I don't think that they've been incorporated into commercial products, but that may happen. So, you know, it's an area that there's a lot of development going on.
Thank you very much,
sir. All right, thank you. About 15 minutes left in this part of the show. Again, just want to mention our guest is Joel Swisher from the Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass, Colorado. We're talking about some of the information you can find in a report that he was involved in. He was one of the authors, came out last fall, looks at the economic benefits of making electrical resources the right size. It's titled Small is Profitable. And if you're interested, you can find out more about it by going to their website, rmi.org. That's RMI for Rocky Mountain Institute. Again, questions are welcome here too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Back here to, or actually we'll go next to someone in Chicago, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. What do other countries do for electric generation, like Poland or Australia or South Africa?
Well, different countries have all different sources of power. The three that you mentioned specifically are fairly similar. They all rely mostly on coal, which is similar to the United States. The United States gets a little over half of its total electricity production from burning coal.
I see. And as the population increases, there'll be a half a billion Americans in 100 years. How are you going to supply all those people with electricity?
Well, that's a tough question. I think we would certainly suggest that the only possible solution would include the use of electricity in ways that are much, much more efficient than what we do today. And fortunately, the technology for a lot of that improvement is already available, and more is being developed every day. That said, though, we're still going to have to be able to generate power, and clearly more of it is going to have to come from cleaner sources, such as renewable sources, including solar and wind. Today, there are really two renewable sources of power that are fairly cost-effective. One is hydropower, but we've pretty much used all of the resources that are reasonable there. There's not a lot of growth. But the other is wind. And wind power is the fastest-growing source of new electricity supply over the last few years, both in the United States, but even more internationally, particularly Europe, has no emissions. It is not really a distributed source in the sense that you're going to put a wind farm on your house. You could in certain situations, but mostly wind looks more like a traditional generator. It's going to be out in some probably rural area where there's lots of wind.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, it may be beginning to change some of the sort of economics and possibly the politics of a lot of rural areas in the heartland, in the sense that the payments, the lease that a wind turbine can offer to a farmer, let's say, to use a piece of their land to site wind turbines, can be more or less equivalent to the net income that the farmer gets from farming. So that is to say that you can use, you know, 1, 2, maybe 3% of your land to site a wind turbine and equal the income that you get on the other 98% of your land. And so it's potentially a pretty important source of wind, source of energy from the wind, and what we need to do is work out some of the problems as far as access to the transmission grid and balancing or firming, as they say in the industry, the intermittent nature of the wind resource that, you know, the wind's blowing stronger at certain times and weaker at other times. Although if you combine a number of different sites together, it's possible to balance those out so that you have a fairly constant, reliable source of power.
Are there any countries that are ahead of us?
Well, in wind, certainly some of the European countries are ahead of us. Denmark, although it's very small, has traditionally been kind of the leader in technology, and they probably have the largest share of about a quarter of all their power comes from wind today, and it's growing. Germany's been very aggressive in developing wind. Spain just recently has become one of the biggest users of wind, and UK and Netherlands as well.
All right, thank you.
No, thank you. We have some other calls here. I just real quick want to mention something related to the weather. We have been talking about that today, the fact that we are expecting some wintry weather in our part of the country right now and this afternoon. And just want to caution people, if you're going to be driving, that the reports are that the roads around our area here are quickly becoming icy as freezing drizzle is falling over much of the area. There are reports of vehicles having spun out and gone off the roads. I think our own meteorologist, Ed Kieser, is now expecting that perhaps we might not get as much snow out of this storm as we thought, but that wintry mix, that is likely to be a problem with an icy mix continuing this afternoon. So we just want to mention to people, if you're going to be out driving this afternoon, do indeed be careful. We also have the school closing information. Villa Grove schools now are going to be closing at 1:30. That's in addition to the early dismissal by the schools in Monticello, with White Heath at 1, Washington, Lincoln, and Monticello High School at 1:20, middle school at 1:30, and no afternoon kindergarten there. We'll have more information on the weather for you as part of the afternoon magazine. If we have more closings, of course, we'll pass those on to you. And then Ed Kieser will have the latest on the weather at 12:35. On to other callers here. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to throw in a vote there for a geothermal heating. We just recently built a house here in Champaign County and been living in about a year. And if you do the numbers with the rate break you get in the winter on the electric rate, geothermal really pays off, even though I think, in my opinion, it's still a little overpriced for considering the incremental cost, but it does pay off, and it's certainly, if you're building a house, it's worth seriously looking into it for the cost factor. And secondary thing is, we found out that it's a very comfortable heat too. We've been very happy with it, both in terms of air conditioning and heating. But the other point you made, guest made, was that you really need to make sure the house is well insulated, and one of the things that was recommended to us was that we have 6-inch exterior walls, which we did. But in general, it's turned out to be a really good investment, and I'm glad we did it.
Very good. Well, thanks for the comment. I don't know, anything else you want to add to that, Dr. Swisher?
Well, just to say that I think the economics are even more attractive for geothermal heat pumps in commercial buildings. We've seen a lot of good applications in things like schools and that sort of commercial and institutional building as well.
Okay. I thank the caller. Let's go to someone else. This is Terre Haute, Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wonder what Dr. Swisher thinks about the possibility of nuclear fusion. I understand the EU in southern France, in a place called Cadrache, is building a lab and a plant, starting to right now, and hoping to obtain money internationally for this. From what I've heard, it would be ideal if we can ever achieve it.
Well, I think that ever achieving it is pretty doubtful, but I don't know about being ideal. People talk about fusion as being, removed from a lot of the problems of conventional nuclear fission technology. It's not necessarily true. There are safety and waste and proliferation issues as well. But I guess it's not really on our radar screen, thinking how expensive even conventional nuclear technology is. There hasn't been a nuclear power plant ordered in the United States and actually built since the Nixon administration.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if you're enough of a technological optimist to think that that's going to pan out, then you ought to be pretty convinced that solar power and fuel cells will be very cheap and very efficient and widely used so much sooner that fusion probably wouldn't matter anyway. I can't say that I'm a technical expert on the physics of it, but technologically it doesn't really seem like it's a very high priority in our viewpoint. And then the other thing is that the issue of the compelling economics of distributed power and the use of cogeneration of power closer to the point of use, again, goes against the highly centralized nature of nuclear power in particular.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, it seems that we do, again, keep bumping up against economic issues. And we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that over time, economics did factor large centralized plants. And there was this economy of scale that over time did manage to bring down the cost of electricity significantly. Now, I know some people thought that it would come down to the point where it was almost nothing, and that didn't happen. But it has come down from its high point. What's going to have to happen for some of these alternatives that we keep talking about, particularly renewables, to get to the point where that they where they are economically competitive with power that's produced in these more conventional ways by these large centralized generators?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. When we were looking at the economics of the power sector, we found that looking at the centralized steam turbine plants, that is the coal and the nuclear plants, they actually stopped getting more efficient as early as the 1960s. Hmm. They stopped getting cheaper in the 70s, and they stopped getting bigger in the 80s, and for the most part, they stopped getting built in the 90s. And so now the power sector has moved to a much smaller class of generators, mostly in using natural gas, but there's concern now about the gas markets. So as far as switching to renewables, really the issue is the cost of the technology, which is only going to come down as we use more of it from the learning and the economies of mass production, and then the ability to balance the intermittent sources of power with solar and wind obviously are available at certain places more at one time than another. And typically the way the power planners think of this is, well, you have to make that source completely reliable and completely available 100% of the time. But the fact that we have a grid, and one of the reasons we don't advocate getting rid of the grid, is you can use it to balance out sources that produce more power at different times, and wind in particular. You can look at the resource from a statistical standpoint and see that certain places produce more wind power at different times, and if you add them together, you get a fairly uniform output. And then the third thing is probably regulatory. We need to start to treat decentralized sources, and particularly intermittent renewable sources, which are very different from what we're used to using in the power sector. We need to begin to treat them as equals and to take advantage of their benefits, that is, being clean and being able to provide some of the benefits we describe in the book, and compensate for their disadvantages, the fact that renewables are intermittent, for example, and that distributed sources are only able to meet the loads on site. And today we still have power sector regulation, and again, that's made mostly at the state level, so we get 50 different sets, but almost all of them are still pretty hostile to distributed power in particular, and the utility companies are so much more comfortable with centralized power that you really have to push them pretty hard to get them to consider the requirements for interconnecting distributed power and to make it easier and to work with the developers of these systems to indeed capture some of the benefits that we talk about. So there's a lot of regulatory reform that we need. And then I guess the second part of it would just be more volume leading to lower costs. Hmm.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we have come to the end of the time. And again, for people who are interested in getting into the subject in more depth, you can look at this book-length report that we have talked about, Small is Profitable, The Hidden Economic Benefits of Making Electrical Resources the Right Size, put together by the folks at the Rocky Mountain Institute. Our guest this morning, Joel Swisher, one of the authors. You can go to their website, which is www.rmi.org, and you can find out more about the report. You can take a look at the executive summary. You can order a copy and also see some of the other things that the folks there at Rocky Mountain are involved in. And Dr. Swisher, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.